I'm Nikki Nolan, and this is Matter of Life and Debt, a show about people in the United States and their student debt. Today's episode, canceling student loan debt. I talk with Winter, an organizer for the Debt Collective. In our conversation, not only did I learn so much about the history of the fight for student debt cancellation, but also about some of the reasons we got into this student debt crisis to begin with. I hope you enjoy the ride. Welcome to the podcast! It's so good to have you here.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me here. I'm so super excited to be here.
So let's get into this. How much student debt do you have?
I actually just pulled up my spreadsheet because I used to not keep track of it, but something turned in my brain where I was like, I'm going to start keeping track of every dime that they claim that I owe them. And so right now, the total, including interest, is $137,176.98. And that's as of last March. It's probably a little higher, actually.
Are they federal? Are they private?
It's a combination of both. So let's see. The private ones, if I did quick math, looks like it's about 25 and 60. Wow. The private ones are 85, which means that the public ones are probably around 50, which is completely crazy. But yeah, the really crazy part about that, though, is that the principal on all of this is 78,000 and the interest is 58,000.
What? Do you know what your interest rates are?
Depends on the different types of loans. So the federal loans are all 6.8, and pretty much all the private ones are 10.8, which is completely scammed when I was 20 years old. And yeah, by Navient, known to all student debtors, the evil Sally Mae tried to change their name to Navient so they could hide from their bad press, but we know who they are.
So did you purposely choose private versus public, or how did you get into that loan composition?
Yeah, it's such a kind of a banal story. And it really, to me, though, illustrates how absurd and awful this system is. I was 20 years old and I had a little bit of money from my father and I was going to a state school for my undergrad. And I wanted to study abroad in England. And that was the only place I could go because it was the only language I spoke. And it was expensive. It was like 25 grand or something. I knew I would need more loans for my last year in college too. So I knew I was going to rack up 40 or 50 grand just to finish. So I went to my father, and at that time we're pretty solidly middle class, but he was going through the moment. We'll just call it that. I'm not going to get into the full story, but he was having some financial difficulties and couldn't really support my wish to study abroad. I asked him, how does this work? Do I fill out a FAFSA? Can we get some aid? And then he was like, no, I think our income is too high. I don't think you're going to get any aid. So you should just take out the loans. You're not going to get aid. I went to the financial aid office and I told them, I need money for study abroad. And I think that we make too much money to get aid. And so I'm not sure what kind of loans I should take out. I've never filled out any forms or anything. And the woman literally, I think she was distracted. She literally just gave me a pamphlet from Sally Mae. I didn't know what the fuck I was doing. And I didn't ask my father. I was just kind of like, oh, you just go to this website and you just fill out a form and then you get the loans. I didn't know private, federal, none of that stuff. I didn't know what the hell I was doing. I just needed the money. And it was like, the deadline was coming up. And it was just, like on their website, it was just like, need student loans? Here you go. And I was like, okay. So I did that and they gave me, 25 grand or whatever it was. Yeah. And that was how it started. it's so crazy. It's like, I mean, when I look back at it now, after, a decade of understanding the system and being an organizer and activist, I'm like, that financial aid officer really should have given me a FAFSA. Like, what the hell was she doing? Like, was she trained by Sally Mae and getting kickbacks? I know that actually did happen in some places. Mm-hmm. It's not likely because it was a state school, but it's possible. Or was she just like, didn't want to deal, was having a bad day and was cranky. You didn't want to walk someone through the process and was like, here, go figure it out yourself, So I'll never know. To this day, I don't know her name and it's been 20 years. Who knows where she is? But that's how I ended up with these shitty, awful loans. But I'm sure that this helped someone get a yacht in some way, shape, or form, One of Sally Mae's shareholders or their CEOs or something.
You touched on an interesting point, which was that Sally Mae was putting people into those financial aid offices in the 90s and 2000s. So you actually, sometimes when you went to talk to a financial aid person, they were possibly actually working for Sally Mae.
Yeah, it's so fucked up. And when I first learned about John Boehner, and I think it's his daughter, right, who used to work for Sally Mae. And he was one of the folks who was the most adamant about bankruptcy laws and some of the deregulating the student loan industry. and his daughter was working for the biggest student loan company. The obvious collusion and conflict of interest is just so clear when you study the history of student loans. And if I ever got a chance to meet John Boehner, I would have some choice words for him, for sure.
I'm really interested in some of this knowledge that you have about student loans, which we'll talk about a little bit later. But first, I want to learn about sort of the impact student loans has sort of had on your life.
Yeah. And that's, and you know, they go hand in hand, to be honest, the knowledge. And at a certain point, well, I guess we can get into it. But at a certain point, I kind of stopped learning about the system because I was like, this is just a joke. You don't actually need to know anymore. But that does go hand in hand, because there was a moment where I graduated from undergrad, and I had, you know, this 25, 30, whatever it was, from private loans. And then I also took out some federal loans. No, I think I continued to take out private loans. I took out more private loans for my last year at the state school, because I still didn't know about FAFSA until grad school. So I had all this private loan debt, and I was working a really low-paying job in Brooklyn. I moved to Brooklyn, and I had some PTSD in my childhood and really needed to get out of where I was on Long Island. So I was like, I'm just moving to Brooklyn. I'll just take any job that I can. You know, I'm interested broadly in education and, you know, changing the world. So I got a nonprofit job paying $28,000 a year and paying my own in a shared apartment. And I couldn't even make ends meet. I had to use a credit card just to get by. And that's when it dawned on me, oh my God, that not only am I going deeper into debt, I'm never going to pay off these loans. It's just never going to happen, because I'm never going to be a Wall Street broker or nonprofit. Maybe you work 20 years and you make it to 80 grand or 90 grand. This is just never going to happen. And I was also enrolled in grad school at the time and in philosophy. And I had this realization that I was just in this debtor's prison, and I was never going to get out of it. And I remember I had a breakdown on the street. I just like collapsed and just wept. I was like walking with my girlfriend, and we were talking about it, and I just like broke. And that was around the same time that I was taking these classes with Stanley Aronowitz, who in New York was a CUNY professor. He tried to run for mayor. He was a very well-known intellectual, radical intellectual. And he was giving a class on the history of socialism and communism in the U.S., and him and his friend were really adamant about, I was the only young person in the class, me and one other person. And they sat with us and they were basically like, we think the student loan thing, we know you both have a lot of student loans and you're feeling trapped by it. We think that this is a big deal for millennials and that you should organize around it. You should talk to other student debtors and build a movement and really look at some of the larger systemic things that are happening. So it was through my own realization of my debtor's prison and then realizing that this was a really potential, powerful issue to organize around that led me to get involved in the student debt organizing, which completely changed my life. So in a lot of ways, it determined my life. It opened up the gateway for me to go into organizing and activism, which was the biggest thing that ever happened to me. So yeah, it's just had so many more impacts. Like even during that time, so that was right before Occupy Wall Street happened. Like literally, that conversation they had with us was a month before Occupy Wall Street. So a month later, you know, I went down to Occupy Wall Street. I saw all these people with all these signs about student loans. Everyone was talking about student loans. I met people who wanted to do a strike around it. Even through that process of trying to form this movement with others, which lasted years, I still was thinking about leaving the country because of my loans. You know, I was like, I'm not sure we're going to win this fight. I might need to get the hell out of here because I have no financial future here. And also tired of racism and awful economic system we have here and the imperialism that we're, you know, brutalizing people all over the world so we can live richly. And so I seriously considered moving abroad, and I actually tried it. So it really, and all this was because of student loans. You know, I mean, it really was. Student loans was one of the guiding forces of my young adult life in so many ways. I mean, it's amazing the way that student loans have just dictated the lives of an entire generation, and not in good ways. You know, I mean, I've yet to meet anyone who is like, oh yeah, it made my life better. You know, no, not one person in the thousands and thousands of people I've talked to, student loans.
No one. I have not talked to one person that was like, yeah, this is great. Or even the people I've talked to who have paid off their loans have this deep pain inside of them that is just unhealable. So it's mind-blowing to me to read some of the information on the other side about the reasons why you shouldn't forgive student debt is because it won't activate the economy to the level of these other kind of things. And I'm just like, what is the price of pain?
Yeah, no, I think that's really right. And I think what you can see, and especially what's happened recently, because our movement has been really successful, and it took us 10 years to get these arguments into the mainstream, but once Biden's election, it became really clear that some kind of student debt cancellation was going to happen. It became very real. And I think that's when we saw all of these like, very like centrist and sometimes conservative policy wonks coming out and being, oh, but student debt is regressive and its cancellation is regressive and it's not fair. And then there's all these super wonky conversations around, well, should we cancel 50 or 75? And what's the most economical? You can tell these people have no idea of the psychological and just very real concrete pain that this is causing for tens of millions of people, right? And it just shows you how these systems are built on just these economic calculations, right? I mean, it's, and this is why in the debt collector we talk about the financialized economy, and I think that's what happens is it turns our policymakers into financial calculators when they make decisions about policies, as opposed to listening to the pain of their constituents and then responding out of that. You know, like, God forbid we should make policy out of our heart and not out of, you know, some obscure calculation about the GDP growth. I mean, it's really, really disturbing. It can be hard to work within that system and to lift up this pain and have it addressed in a way that just gets met with numbers. It feels really dehumanizing and really violent. But I mean, it's only been recently that the numbers have been on our side that started coming out and being like, well, actually, not only does it stop all this violent pain that's happening across the country, it's also good for the economy. So wait, how strange, you know? And so I think that it just shows how clearly it is the moment, and we were right all along in every way, you know? And now it's time to put aside this absurd economic set of policies we've had for decades. It's time to end them, you know? It's just so clear. It's so clear. Now it's just a matter of like building the political will to make it happen, you know? When we like look out in this world, in this incredibly wealthy country we look at, and yet everyone's broke, right? Everyone's broke and in debt, and yet we live in this incredibly wealthy country. And like there's something happened in my brain where I was just kind of like, this doesn't make any sense, right? What capitalism does is that a small group of people on top basically are just like taking the wealth that the rest of the country and the rest of the population is producing, right? And they're kind of hogging access to it. And they're the ones who control what happens with it and where it goes and what, and you know. And I think that that's basically what a loan is, right? It's basically like that the money that our ancestors worked their ass off, the wealth that our ancestors were the ones who built the buildings, right? And like created all the mm-hmm. objects and like made this world that we live in. It was us that did it. We're the ones who like, it's our collective wealth. Yet there's a small group of people on top who control all of that money, right? And as soon as we want like the tiniest bit of it back, it's our money. As soon as we want it back, mm-hmm. they're like, okay, we'll let you have it, but only with like massive interest rates, right? Like we'll let you, sure, we'll give you a little bit of money to go to school, but only if, you know, you basically agree to like work your ass off, you know, work 70 hours a week, a job you don't want, because that's the kind of economy we want, right? We want an economy mm-hmm. where like the working people are exhausted, they can't rebel, and they just owe us so much money that they need to work 7 jobs and they're broke and they can't quit their job and they can't take any risks and they can't join a social movement. And so I think for me, when I understood that perspective, I was like, oh, it's not, there's a strategy here. There's a strategy of the ruling class, and like, it's not by accident, you know, like, and when you look at the history of student loans, like, you know, Ronald Reagan in the 70s said exactly that. I mean, he was basically like, we need to install tuition in the University of California system because these kids are entitled and they're rebelling. I mean, it's clear as day. We need tuition to control these people because otherwise they're going to think that they're entitled to this wealth that their ancestors built, right? And I think it's especially true when you realize that what was happening in that moment were the black and brown people who built the majority of this wealth were the ones entering college. And they were the ones who were like really, especially in University of California and CUNY in New York, were entering for the first time, entering en masse into the free education system. And, you know, the old white rich guard were like, we can't have this. So the only way they can come into this system is if we, you know, install these like massive loans and basically put them in debtor's prison, you know? So I think that's like really important, I think, to understand that. It's that it's not an accident. You know, these loans didn't come out of nowhere, right? It's a very clear strategy of the ruling mm-hmm. class to maintain their wealth and power and control. I mean, it's really that simple, you know?
And it's working so well.
It works so well. I mean, the interest is their profits. That's why I say like the interest is their yacht, you know, the interest is their fourth home in the Bahamas. It's like, that's how it works. I mean, this is the whole like premise of the debt collector, but there's a great power in us realizing that as debtors and then being like, well, let's not give them that money because they're irresponsible and they're going to use it for yachts. Instead, I'm going to keep it in my community. I'm going to give it to my local grocer or my local like black restaurant owner. That's the responsible thing to do with this money, not give it to banks and whoever's making a profit off of the government money. So that's my spiel.
This is a good point to transition into. What is your story? Let's start early on. What your dreams were through where you are in reality.
Yeah, I mean, it's really, I was thinking about that. What were my dreams when I was a kid? And I actually don't know, because I lost my mother at a young age. I was 10, and then my family was ripped apart, and it was very, very rough. And I really was in a blur for a year, my entire like adolescent and teenage years, up until college and even later. I really was dissociated and not really present. And so I kind of lost my dreams. I didn't really have dreams. And so in a lot of ways, all I knew was that I needed to go to college because that's what people did in my class, you know, in middle class, white suburbia. That's what people did. You go to college. And really, that was my family and society's expectations. And so that's what I did, you know. And it wasn't really like I was going after something. I think actually I was running away. You know, I was running away from like a house in a community where it didn't feel right, you know. And so it was more just like seeking answers. Like, why couldn't I get the love and the care that I needed, right? And so I really went, college was kind of a place where I could begin to think about these questions, right? And so I took like classes in philosophy and psychology and religion, trying to like history and politics to make some sense of what happened in my life and in my childhood. In a lot of ways, it was less like chasing a dream and more like maybe my dream was just to get answers, right? Just to like make some sense of my experience and my reality and my society, you know. I had a total crisis when I had to go to college. I don't know what the hell I want to be. Like, I'm depressed. You know, like, depressed people don't want anything. They just want to sleep. But I was like, okay, well, at that time I liked sports. I was like, maybe I should, you know, be a sports journalist. Or I was like, I like computers. I was like, maybe I'll be a computer scientist. So I actually declared a computer science my major, and I went to like two or three classes and I hated them. And I, you know, failed all the classes and I dropped out. I wasn't going to class. And I got lucky. I ended up taking one philosophy class and I just fell in love with it. And I was like, this is my people, you know, who are like asking questions about reality and society. And who are we? And what is this? And why is that that? And so, yeah, so once I took that class, I changed my major to philosophy. And then I obsessively took philosophy classes for the next 3.5 years.
After you got your degree, what did life look like after you graduated?
I knew that I wanted to be an activist. I'd been an activist in college and had been exposed to a lot of US policies in Latin America and a lot of the history of US imperialism and colonialism. And I, you know, started questioning capitalism pretty seriously. And so when I was in Brooklyn, I really started trying to figure out, I wanted to be part of some kind of movement or some kind of organization that was thinking about what a different kind of world could look like, what a different kind of society could look like that was more equal and less violent. But I spent several years just kind of bumbling around. I went to different meetings and then nothing really seemed like it resonated until Occupy Wall Street. And that's really when like things kind of really started taking off for me and my life really started to take form.
Tell me a little bit about Occupy Wall Street and sort of like what happened for you there.
I remember the first day I went down there, it was right after the incident on the, I think with the pepper spray. So it must have been late September, early October. And I remember going down there my first time, and I absolutely loved it. There was just a bunch of people in a hodgepodge kitchen in a park next to Wall Street. And there was a drum circle and a meditation area and like a little library. And I was like, wait, like there's no, this is all just self-organized. These are just people who are just like, oh, I'm going to make a library. And but what really got me was there was an assembly, and apparently this was happening every night, and there was like 1,000 people, and it was a democratically run assembly with a facilitator, and we all broke into groups and talked about what we wanted our society to look like. And I met cool 5 or 10 people. We had an amazing discussion. And this is really cool. Like, this isn't, obviously this is not just about like how fucked up Wall Street and financial capitalism is. Like, this is about like a generation of people or more. I mean, it wasn't just my generation, who are like, something is deeply wrong with our society, you know, and we are looking for a completely different way of living, right? And of like relating to one another. And that actually like the problems in Wall Street and the problems in financial capitalism and problems with racism are actually like, they're about relationships. They're about the way we live and about the way we relate to another. It's not just about like, you know, a hierarchical system and whatever. So that to me, it was this like two-part nature to Occupy Wall Street that got me. That was like, on the one hand, you know, protesting the bailout and just like in general the conditions of capitalist life in America, the debt and, you know, just the low end, you know, lack of safety net and, you know, the police violence. So a combination of like protesting that, but then also kind of, you know, getting together and talking about what kind of
world do we want to see? And what kind of, relationships and communities do we want to have? What would it look like to have a fair world? What would it feel like? And so that immediately, I was like, this is a movement I want to be a part of. This is something really beautiful and powerful and huge, right? That's just like taking the country by storm and really like creating a ruptious, like horrible system that we live under. From Occupy Wall Street, we had started a group called the Occupy Student Debt Campaign. There were probably about 10 of us, maybe 15 of us who were really committed. And I joined maybe a week or two after they had formed the group. And I remember I went to a meeting on Occupy Wall Street, and I remember Andrew Ross and Pam Brown, two very charismatic people who I think were really key in starting this movement. And they both kind of gave a talk on like, the horror of student loans and how fucked up the economy is and how education should be free. And, all the kind of like core talking points the Debt Collective uses now. And I remember them saying, we don't know the exact number, but there's something like, between 5 and 10 million people who are in default, right? Who are beyond 90 to 100 days of not paying their bills and are dealing with the consequences of default, which are, a ruined credit score and wage garnishment, and they'll lose their Social Security. And they were saying, these people are actually on strike. If you look at it, what we have here is a kind of strike. And what we need to do is organize these people into a group and say, instead of saying like, we are not paying because our financial life is too difficult and we just can't make the payments, instead turn into a voluntary strike and say like, no, actually we are on strike because the system is wrong and here are our demands. Cancel the debt, free college, etc. And so that was the first attempt to kind of like, I don't want to say go on debt strike because there already is a debt strike happening, right? And I think that's really important to acknowledge. But what we wanted to do was name it, right? And actually bring those people together and say, actually, you have power, actually. Like, if you realize that, like, systems that exist in the financial economy need our payments, our monthly payments to survive, then you actually realize by withholding our money, we actually have power over them. So that was our first attempt to really, I mean, in a sense, it's a union, right? We tried to create a union to go on strike. And it was really difficult in those early days. The country wasn't quite ready for this movement. We went out in public, starting to talk about this and starting to say like, it's actually, the moral thing to do is actually not pay your loans. And we don't want anyone to deal with the consequences on their own. So that's why we're building a collective, a group of people who are actually gonna do that together, right? And support each other through not paying their loans in whatever way that could look like, right? It might look like deferring or forbearance. So that was our first attempt. And we saw very quickly the backlash we got. And it wasn't just from like conservatives, and it wasn't just from like baby boomers who had gone to college for $1,000 and were like, why can't you pay your student loans? Even people who were, fairly liberal and progressive would be like, oh no, well, but I mean, you signed a contract. I mean, that's only fair. I mean, it's like very, that's wrong. It's wrong not to pay your bills. That's just like, that's just wrong. And people couldn't say why it was wrong. People just kind of had this like deep core intuition that this is what bad people did. This is what like dropouts and beatniks did. Like, and so that was really hard for us to push back against. And it was, we really had to like say clearly, well, no, but like, think about it. If you believe that education is a public good and that it could be free, like it is in most countries around the world, then why do we even have these loans? And so like, if we shouldn't have them, why should we pay them? So like, it took people a while to kind of like really settle into that logic. And I mean, when I say a while, I mean like really until 2018, 19, until Bernie Sanders. Because like, even now we still get people pushing back on it. And I love, Andrew Ross used to say, and I love this, he used to say that like in neoliberal society, like the financial economy that we live in, breaking your contract is basically an equivalent to incest, right? Like it's just like a taboo that you just don't do. And it's not really questioned why, right? I mean, except that once you start looking at it, it's because, well, financial economy is run on contracts. And so if you begin to say, well, maybe some of these contracts aren't really legitimate, then the whole system is kind of put into question. The whole financial system, the whole system that Wall Street has created in the past 30 or 40 years is put into question. And so I think it's taken a long time to really begin to question that basic assumption that you have to pay your bills if you sign a contract. But I think it's a really important one to challenge and to overturn, to say like, no, actually not really. Like the conditions under which we signed those contracts were actually very exploitative. And it's not a coming together of two equals. It's not like we both have an equal amount of power in the society and we're going to sign a contract that says we're going to share this or share that, or you're going to lend me this, or you're going to lend me that. It's actually someone with no power at all. Coming and just like trying to do something that's just very basic to their survival. And then someone with a lot of power saying, okay, fine, but you can only do it if you agree. And it's, we started to call it mafia capitalism, because in a sense, we started realizing that like the housing market, the education market, even just the basic consumer economy that's all run on loans is kind of the mafia economy, right? It's basically like these hedge funds and the banks that have all the control over capital in our society are kind of like the mafia. And we're just saying like, we just need some money to live. And they're like, okay, but you're going to pay back with 10% compounding interest for the rest of your life. And you're like, okay, fine. I just need to go to school so I can get a job, you know? So I think it is really important to shift that narrative. And one of the biggest things that I see happen is when we like really flip the script a little bit and say to people like, these loans are illegitimate. We say that, people are like, well, what do you mean? And we're like, well, we don't think you should have them in the first place, right? Because in a decent society, education would be free because it's a public good. It's good for society. There's no reason why it shouldn't be free. It is in most of the world. And so when that, if that's the case, there shouldn't be loans. Therefore, your loans aren't legitimate and you really shouldn't even be paying them. This whole system of student loans shouldn't even exist. And I think once you do that, it creates a kind of shift in your brain where you kind of say like, oh, wait a minute. Yeah, like I was caught in a really shitty scam that the government was part of, and that the government was interested in because there was a certain set of ideologies and policies that told them this was a good idea. And once you see it that way, then you can begin to look into how the system is created from a more like detached way, and not in a way of like, how am I going to get out of it? But instead, like, what is this crazy machine that they built to trap me? And like, what are the ways in which there are like little hacks and little ways you can kind of break into it? And I think that it's actually, I've seen that that can be really empowering for people to understand the system, and especially from a different like moral angle, not as, hey, I got to understand this because I got to get my way, not like in a desperate way, but in a kind of like, right, okay, yeah, so I've been fucked. Like, let me really understand who fucked me and why and how. And then, like, especially if you're in dialogue with others about that, because then you're not like so alone and you're like, oh, it wasn't just me. It wasn't a personal decision that I made that was a failure. It was like all structural policies, a set of policies that led an entire generation or led tens of millions of people into the same trap. And so I'm very ordinary actually for being in this trap. There's tens of millions of us in this trap. I think there's something really, really important.
45 million, right? Around 45 million people are stuck in this trap.
Yeah, exactly. And I think one of the things that was unique about Obama, I'm not a fan totally of Obama's set of work, but and one of the things that was unique about him is that he actually did have student loans when he went into office. Him and Michelle both had loans. And granted, they were lawyers. They weren't super rich. I mean, he started making money when he was in the Senate, but to that point, they had struggled. But I think we're seeing a new wave of like AOC and Tlaib and Omar. They all have student loans. And there's other like young progressive Congress people who have student loans. But I think one of the things that we've really been focusing on in the Debt Collective is not just focusing on student loans, but like we've been talking a lot about like household debt. Or like community debt, and really seeing debt as like something that kind of moves through the whole community and through like households. Because yeah, I mean, the stat is like one out of every six people in the United States have student loans, right? It's 45 million out of 300 million, right? But then like, well, you're like, well, yeah, obviously like all the people under 15 don't have student loans. So that takes out a big chunk of the population. And then you're like, wait a minute, but people don't, most people in this country don't live in studios all on their own. Like most people live in a home, right? Like with several other people. And so like when you're like, yeah, actually the average family size, I don't know what it is, 3, 4, 5. Like when you look at it like that, you're actually like, oh, well, in that case, basically almost every household in the United States has student loans, basically. And then when you're like, well, not only that, but actually when you look at the household finances, it's not just student loans. Like people have either mortgages or rent. Like they have some kind of monthly bill that's a debt that they owe for the place that they're living. They're, you know, generally don't own it. Even if they have a mortgage, they don't really own it. And then they probably have some like medical bills, a decent chance they have medical debt, the credit card debt. I mean, it's just like a ton of people, auto loans, and then student loans. So actually, when you look at it, like, yeah, the entire economy is run on debt. And so like the households that we live in are just drowning in debt. And so I think it's really important that we look at student loans, not just as like one issue that's affecting these 45 million people, but as a really important part of how households are experiencing financial life in America. This is why in Occupy Wall Street was like the 99%, because it really is like the 1% are in Congress and in Senate, and that they don't have households that look like this at all, right? Their households are not drowning in debt, whereas I think it's something like, it's actually like 80% of households have debt. So those 80% of households though, more or less, there might be like 5% of them that are pretty comfortable, but even folks I know in the like professional middle class are really struggling with all the different bills and debts they owe. And so I think that there's something about student loans that hits at this fundamental way in which life is lived in the US, which is like we're drowning in bills, right? And mm-hmm. debt is a more technical way of saying bills, right? Like, but so I think that, that's why there's so much energy around student loans, right? Because clearly education should not be putting people into these horrible situations. But it's also once you graduate without student loans, then you're just walking into a life with even more debt. And then I think it really does begin to shine a spotlight into like the horror, to be honest, of living in the United States, like the way that money is lived, the way that money is distributed, the way that resources are distributed. And I think both of our stories, you can hear that in our stories, like that we realize like, oh, I can't live a life. Like I can't live a regular life because even if it wasn't student loans, like, you know, if I have medical bills too and credit card bills and like, it's not just my student loans that I'm worried about. It's like I was saying, it's a basic economy where we have to go into debt to meet our basic needs. And that is fundamentally wrong. And we should really resist all of these debts. And so in those early days, we started talking about the union. Actually, we were kind of like, I think what we need is a union for debtors. I think we're seeing the beginning of a movement like the labor movement where people are realizing they need to come together mm-hmm. and negotiate with their creditors, do strikes, build collective power. The transition from strike debt to debt collective was, there were two projects that kind of like created that transition. We knew that we had to like put this analysis out there in the world. So one project we had was called the Debt Resistors Operations Manual. And it was like 10 chapters, one chapter on each type of debt, and just like how the system worked, just the nuts and bolts, and then how you could resist in different ways. And then it was also kind of like an introduction that kind of framed like mafia capitalism and we shouldn't have to go into into debt to meet our basic needs. At the same time, we had heard about Thomas Gokey, who's now one of my co-organizers of the Debt Collective. And he had heard, it had been kind of like the word had been getting around that due to some like financial deregulations in the 80s, you could actually buy debt on the secondary market, like consumer debt. You know about this? Yeah. So
John Oliver did it, right? John Oliver.
Well, yeah, that's all another long story. He didn't credit us, which was really shitty.
That is shade. That's some shade, John.
He talked to I wasn't part of the group at the time, but he talked to our organizers, and instead he credited the charity nonprofit that was a spinoff of what we did, and he didn't talk about the 5, 6, 7 years of social movement work that went into that process. He just decided it wasn't worth it. So as usual, you know, mainstream media, they don't really like to cover people power and social movements. It's much more interesting to cover charity. So it's kind of how it goes. But yeah, but John Oliver popularized this concept. But at the time in Occupy, it was kind of a murmur. People were like, it's crazy. Can you really? So Thomas Gokey, he lived upstate New York and he did it. He found a relationship with a debt collector and he bought like 100 bucks worth of debt and he got like $5,000 in debt for 100 bucks, something like that. And so we reached out to Thomas and he was kind of part of Occupy. And we were like, we're thinking about doing this on a broader level and fundraising maybe like $50,000 and get like $1 million in debt. And then we can like really just like have a big stunt and just say to the world, like, look how weird and crazy and fucked up this system is. Like, what is it? If your debt can be sold for 5 cents and then collected on at the full value, what is it really worth? If you have a bill with a hospital and they just write it off on their taxes or they sell it for 10 cents on the dollar, why should you have to pay? Wasn't that actually the value of the cost? Where does that extra 90 cents go? Like, what? It really shows that like the debt system isn't really based in real value, right? Just like in Wall Street, all these prices are just balloon speculation. And why should we have to pay a full price if the debt buyers and debt collectors are paying 5, 10 cents on the dollar? So we were like, let's try to fundraise some money and get a bunch of debt. So we put on this big event. We had some folks who knew like some celebrities in New York. We put on like a big kind of like telethon, we called it, in New York City. We had like a whole social media campaign. We got some celebrities to kind of blog and tweet us. And we wanted to raise $50,000, like I said, and cancel $1 million. We ended up raising $800,000 or something at the end of the day. And we're able to cancel like $30 million in debt. It was a long process. It was very complicated to get into the industry and create the nonprofit and figure out all the legal code. And it was just super messy and complicated. And even like buying debt is a really messy process. You don't know whose debt you're getting. It's all coded in spreadsheets. And it's hard to get in contact with these debtors to even let them know that it's canceled. So it's not by any means like a way to fix the debt problem because it's not sustainable. It's really, for us, it was a way to demonstrate to the public how absurd the system was and to help people out along the way. Let's help out 5-10,000 debtors, get this debt canceled, but also show people like, look, debt cancellation can happen. It actually makes a lot of sense. So we called it the Rolling Jubilee. Because there is this like, you know, biblical concept of canceling debt. And we were like, let's revive this. This is actually an old tradition that is we need it in the modern times, right? Because we're all drowning in debt. So from there, we didn't quite know what to do. And this is a long story. There was a lot of like argument on what do we do and group dynamics. But eventually a subgroup of that, they found out that a bunch of students in Corinthian College in California were going on strike because they had learned about the fraudulent practices in their school. Kamala Harris was actually suing them as the attorney general in California, coming full circle with Kamala. And so they got in touch with these students and they were like, look, we want to cancel this for-profit student loan debt. You all are going on strike. Why don't we join forces and we can see if other schools want to go on strike and we can actually build like a whole movement of people going on strike. And so this was really the beginning. This is when the Debt Collective started. This was really the first like campaign of the Debt Collective was to organize with for-profit students who had been scammed. And at this point, there were all sorts of reports coming out on the fraudulent practices that these schools were doing. I mean, it was so predatory. They were just lying to students flat out about job placement rates and their connections in the community. They were taking out loans in their names without telling them. I mean, it was just like the Wild West. It was such a deregulated market. As what we started to learn and what we started to see as we pieced together this story was that as the federal government and state governments had cut back on funding to public schools, and therefore they couldn't enroll as many students, and as the markets were deregulated and the private university system opened up to all sorts of shady practices, these for-profits formed and really started preying on low-income communities and their dreams. That kind of started to put the pieces together of like, oh, wow, look, this is not only is this impacting people who go to public schools and NYU and private schools, it's actually, there's this whole group of students who are just completely fucked, that are already coming out of poverty. And then on top of that are going to these fake schools that are giving them shitty diplomas that won't get them anything. They're totally being, you know, preyed upon. So this was starting to come to light. And so there was a real clear campaign there. And Debt Collective was able to organize, I mean, thousands of these students and actually created a form. One of the things that we found has worked really well in doing this kind of work with debt is when you can find like we were saying earlier, when you really look at these systems closely and you can find like the legal loopholes. And so one of the lawyers on our team found this loophole that basically said, I mean, not a loophole, it was just a piece of law in one of the higher ed bills. And it basically said, if your university has created any kind of state crime or it's basically committed any kind of crime or has broken the law in any way, your loans are actually no longer valid. The tuition is basically void.
Wow.
Yeah. So what the Debt Collective did in a genius way, I think, is created an actual form. Like they created a form for the government to say, my school broke the law, therefore you owe me debt cancellation. And then organized, I think it was like 10,000 students or so who filled out this form. And then the Debt Collective went to the Department of Education, called a meeting, got a meeting with like the deputy secretary or whatever, and came in with boxes of these forms. And then that started a process of actually figuring out, okay, the Department of Education was like, you're right. And now we need to make a process for how we're going to figure out how to cancel these loans. And so that was really the first time that, you know, we proved basically that student loans could be canceled and should be canceled. So really the next step from there was to say like, oh, actually it's not just the for-profits that are, you know, a scam. It's actually the whole education system, the whole higher ed. And so all the loans should be canceled. So that's kind of like, you know, the long story from the first attempt at a debt strike and Occupy in the Park and Occupy Wall Street up until, you know, now, our strike that we have going on now.
Tell me a little bit more about the student debt strike.
You know, we're calling it the Biden Jubilee 100, and it's modeled basically on the first debt strike we had that was successful, which was the Corinthian 15. And those were the 15 students who went on strike from their for-profit debt. And, you know, that enabled us to get a meeting with the Department of Education and get, you know, over $1 billion of debt canceled. So we know that striking our debt is a powerful, powerful thing to do. And it really not only grabs the attention of the media and politicians, but it also allows us to really take the moral ground of saying we don't actually owe the, we should not be paying these bills. We don't owe these bills. You know, it's modeled after that first campaign. And we basically recruited 100 student debtors among our networks to go on strike. And it also gave us the opportunity to build this really powerful community of 100 student debtors who, you know, we're coming together every week with different trainings, and we're having trainings around, you know, how to talk to your, you know, neighbors and about debt, how to talk to the media about debt. So really it's about building pressure, right? Building community and building pressure to lift up our voices as much as possible and really create like a groundswell so that Congress and Biden can't ignore it. And I think at this moment, we really are aware that there's been a lot of conversation in the Senate and among Biden around whether and how much student debt to cancel. It's pretty clear that there's going to be some kind of cancellation. And so our goal is to get him to cancel all of it. In the Senate, Warren and Schumer are pushing for $50,000. And so we're pushing even them to say, no, like you need to cancel all of it. And actually, Joe Biden can do it with just one signature. It's actually that simple. Just one stroke of the pen and an executive action, and Joe Biden can cancel all the federal student loan debt. And so it's really something very simple he could do. It's, an incredible economic stimulus in a really challenging time of economic recession and pandemic. The studies have shown that it would create, like, I think 1 million jobs a year, like almost $100 million that it would add to the GDP per year. It closes the racial wealth gap. Like, it's a clear, like, answer to a lot of the problems we have, and it's really simple, and you can just do it. So really, the campaign is to pressure him to just, like, do it. Don't be afraid. Just take the common sense and just cancel the debt. And so, we are hopeful that we'll be effective and we'll win the debt cancellation. But even if we don't, we're going to do campaigning and striking until we win. So it really is, and it's a commitment for the long term to really win this campaign. So even if it takes longer than 100 days, we'll just create the Biden Jubilee 1,000 or 10,000 or 1 million, whatever it takes to get the debt canceled. So this is just the first step in kind of building out our union and the collective power that we have as debtors.
So if somebody wanted to get involved or just like follow this movement, what would they do?
Yeah, so they can go to debtcollective.org and they can sign our petition. We have a petition that we're calling on Biden to cancel his debt. So, sign the petition, spread that to all their family and friends, join our union. They can give dues if they want to support the movement, $5, $10 a month, or they can sign up for free. They can start coming to our campaign calls, our trainings. They can get involved in a local group. They can lead an action in their community, at a Senate or Congressperson's office. So there's a lot people can do to get involved. There's, a different, from the simplest of just, signing the petition to really getting involved in the union and being an active member and activist.
So one thing I want to ask you, because this comes up time and time again, I see this all over the social media. How can Biden just sign away the debt with the stroke of a pen? Like,
Congress granted the Secretary of Education the authority to, quote unquote, compromise, waive, or release its claims over all student loans. So that means that Biden can instruct the Secretary of Department of Education to release, basically, give up their claim of all $1.5 trillion of federal student loans. And it's the same authority that Trump has used to in his executive actions to, like, pause the interest rates. So we know that it's possible. It's in the law. There's really nothing stopping them. One of our lawyers put out a white paper years ago on this issue. It would hold up in court. So he should just do it. It's really simple. He has the legal authority. And so, yeah, it's written in black and white.
So let's say everything is canceled. Do the taxpayers have to lift that bill? Who pays for this?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the beauties of this policy suggestion is that it actually doesn't cost anyone any money. I mean, it's actually, so the Levy Institute put out a report that says that student loan cancellation would actually be a boost to the economy. It wouldn't actually cost money, it would be a boost. So, I mean, there's like, these arguments that it hurts the government's bottom line, but I mean, it's actually like, doesn't really do anything to the government's budget. I mean, the government's budget is so large. And there's this movement called modern monetary theory about how, like, government deficits, especially in the small amounts of money, really don't matter. And so it's not true that this is going to raise taxes. It's just not true. It won't do anything. It may cause a headache for a few bureaucrats in Washington to figure out how to, like, move some spreadsheets around, but at the end of the day, it doesn't cost taxpayers money and it's good for the economy. So it's like, why wouldn't we do it, right? And like, it just helps people who are suffering tremendously. So it's in an absolute crisis we're in. Senator Elizabeth Warren has said that this is the best way to stimulate the economy through executive action. So Biden should do it immediately, right? And so I think that's really clear. So yeah, when you have people that high up in the government, Elizabeth Warren, knows this stuff better than anyone. So, yeah. So it is frustrating when people say that because I think it's, the way that debt works on the federal level, it's like that doesn't actually, government spending doesn't directly raise people's taxes. It's not the way it works. So I think that's actually really important to say.
Yeah, I think what the modern monetary theory basically says that taxes are, and I'm going to butcher this because I'm just learning about it, that taxes are a way to fight inflation. It's not really like the money that is going into the deficit.
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, they say straight up, they're like, government spending does not mean you need to tax. And it's, I mean, it's even arguable whether or not debt cancellation is government spending. Because most people aren't even paying their student loans. So it's like, they're not even getting this money. So it's like, you know, it's really, they're actually, it's really absurd. It's really absurd. That's why I say like the worst it's going to do is it's going to, like, the only downsides of canceling student debt that I can imagine is that it gives a bunch of bureaucrats a headache on how to figure out, like, their balance their budgets in the Department of Education, which they'll figure out, you know, they're paid enough to do that. Businesses do it all the time. It's not a big deal. Like, it's pretty standard practice to cut your losses on bad debt. You know, it's just like, it's the same thing. It happens all the time in corporations and businesses. It's really a simple procedure. I'm sure the government can figure out how to do it. And then, there, you know, there'll obviously be an impact on the private servicers, and that's too bad. You know, I mean, these are like corporations that have been preying on student debtors for, you know, decades. So there's no love lost that they lose some of their income, you know, and that the shareholders do. It's, you know, it's for me, that's not a big deal. It's well worth it. It's a sad sacrifice that these wealthy services will have to make, you know, for the good of the country. And so when the politicians talk about like, oh, well, we don't need cancellation. We just need to clean up the public student loan forgiveness program or the income-based program. And you're like, no, less than 1% of people are making it through those programs because you've created an absolute bureaucratic nightmare, you know, that's made the right wing look right about government incompetence. Like, it's just an absolute nightmare. It's government and private. It's just a total shit show. And so, like, it's clear that the only real solution is just to, like, cut the head off the beast, just kill the student loan system, you know, and like make education free. Like, we have the goddamn money. So it's really frustrating when they try to like bring us down that road. You know, one of the things that happened in the Debt Collective was they started this process with the Obama Department of Education, with Arne Duncan. And they were not exactly looking out for borrowers, right? They were very business friendly folks in the Department of Education. The Obama staffing was not progressive in any way, shape or form. So we really had to fight tooth and nail for cancellation and for forgiveness, but it did start to happen. What happened when Trump took office was that, I mean, Betsy DeVos came in and she is just like, you know, absolutely no cancellation. We were like, well, it doesn't matter what the law says. Like, our hearts tell us that it's not right. And so we're not going to do it. And so basically that entire program that, you know, the Debt Collective had really initiated, just the gears, I mean, it was like the Trump administration threw sand in the gears and basically stalled for 4 years to give anyone forgiveness that they were due. Even with the Obama administration, they still did not give cancellation to people that were due, or they were giving, you know, small amounts when they should have done all of it. You know, it was clear that the government is afraid to cancel the debt, right? They're just like, they're afraid. And I don't know exactly why, whether it's because they know that then it's clear to us that the whole thing is a game, the whole thing is rigged, or if they're just so entrenched in ideas about, like, you know, no, you took out these loans and this is the right thing to do. And you know, you have to follow through on your commitments. But for whatever reason, Democrats and Republicans alike are hostile to debt cancellation and have been up until the last year. So we really are in like all new territory. I'm in favor of, you know, really trying to push for full cancellation that covers everyone, including private loans. Because I really think that's the only solution moving forward. Because I think any kind of like partial cancellation for just certain segments of the population is a bad idea. I think it's a terrible idea.
Is there anything that we haven't covered that you like really want to talk about?
Yeah, I was saying earlier, you know, black and brown communities entering the college, and that's when Reagan and the, you know, the elite started instilling tuition. You know, it's been an amazing learning process for me as someone who's white. It's been like a really powerful learning process to realize that debt actually has a really long history in communities of color, and like a really long history of being a mechanism of control. You know, that actually goes back to the founding of the country, and like back to Haiti, and like back to, like, you know, the formation of nation states. That debt has always been a way that, like, land has been taken from, you know, indigenous folks, that like slaves were, you know, lives were controlled through, you know, debts they owed to landowners. And it's a really long and old tradition in the United States. And it's new for a lot of white folks, but it's actually like something that has been used for a really long time, right? And that there's a real deep racial component to this. And that, I think that's really important to lift up and to name, and that it's still happening today, right? When you look at student loans and the you know, all sorts of consumer loans, there's racial inequities in every single one of them. So it's really, really important, I think, we center that in all these conversations.
Yeah, I have somebody who's on the show. She's coming on two episodes after you, named Brie, who started something called the Prosperity Project. Basically, she's fundraising and she's doing retroactive debt payoff for Black women. Yeah.
Wow.
So cool.
What do you mean retroactive?
So they have the debt, and so she's giving backwards. She's giving retroactive scholarships backwards to pay off.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's cool. That's really cool.
Isn't that great?
Yeah, I can't wait. I'm definitely gonna listen to that one. That's cool.
So what advice would you give to your younger self, knowing what you know now?
You know, it's crazy enough, but I wouldn't do anything differently. Like, I thought, you know, maybe I'd say, like, don't go to school, it's not worth it. But no, like, you know, the younger me deserved to go to school. And there's no other way besides student loans. I think I would just say to him, like, don't worry about the debt. Like, it's you're going to join a movement later on in life that's going to get it canceled. So don't worry about it. Because it should be free, and those numbers, they aren't real. It'll cause you some stress, but at the end of the day, the people are gonna win free education and debt cancellation. So don't worry about it too much. So I would just say, relax, just relax. Go to the school you want.
I love that. All right, well, we're coming to the end. Is there anything you want to pitch?
Yeah, I think that what we're doing at the Debt Collective is really powerful, you know, trying to create this debtors union. And I want to invite people to join us, to join the union, and to see their debts not as something that is a personal failure and something that they did wrong, but as something that needs to be reversed, like, you know, a policy failure that we can fight together against, and that we're building power, you know, and there's power in a union, and we don't have to go at it alone. And throughout American history and global history is really what changes things, is people coming together and taking action together. And so now is the time to do that around student loans, but also around all different types of loans. And so people can go to debtcollective.org and join the union. And we're building it out. You know, we're building out ways for people to get involved and form locals and, you know, form different campaigns and get involved in the student debt work. And we're going to win. So people should get involved so that they can feel empowered and celebrate us when we get all the debt handled. It's going to be a really great time. But yeah.
Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This was really fun, and looking forward to all the wonderful guests and conversations you're going to have. And I'm going to send all my colleagues your way.
Matter of Life and Debt is produced by me, Nikki Nolan. Special thanks to F.A. Achman for creating the music and mastering the audio. Additional support and thanks to Sarah Tebow, who writes the information and transcripts about each episode. This podcast would not have been possible without them. Visit our website for more information, matteroflifeanddebt.com, where you can listen, read transcripts, get additional context to the subjects you just heard about. Subscribe absolutely for free. That website again, matteroflifeanddebt.com. Thanks again for listening.